We're in the Castro District of San Francisco here. My friend Joseph Chambra, and he's going to tell us today about his escape from the gay lifestyle to be a close disciple of Jesus Christ. And just a little warning out there for everybody, it's going to be PG-13. We're not going to make it a X-rated interview. But again, if there's any families out there listening, we're going to give the PG-13 warning on this. But Joseph, I think we'll just jump in. You were born and raised in California, so I should actually first say thanks for welcoming me to your state.
Thank you, Father.
Tell us a little bit about your childhood and what led you to San Francisco.
Yeah, I was born not far from here, just in the North Bay, just a few miles, and was born and raised a Catholic, a Roman Catholic, in the 1970s, but kind of a cultural Catholic. You know, my dad was, my mother's a convert, but my dad was born and raised in Italy as a Catholic, of course. And, you know, I understood who Jesus was as a boy, and I probably knew a little bit about the saints, not much. Everything I kind of gleaned from, like, Hollywood movies at the time, like the Ten Commandments, The Road, Ben-Hur, things like that. But in Catholic schools, learned really very little, next to nothing. You know, at that time, one of my main memories of Catholic school was watching, like, the movie Godspell, if people remember that. I mean, that was a very, like, 1960s, 70s hippie Jesus. And I didn't have any at all, like, a fully formed conscience about who Christ was. It was very vague. I think I sort of understood that, yes, he's God and the Son of God.
Yes.
But I don't think I really ever really believed it.
Mm-hmm. So, Joseph, if you could tell us maybe just a little bit about that, some of those first trappings that actually ensnared you into what would become a full-blown bad lifestyle.
Well, as a kid, you could kind of say I had a little bit of what I call, like, the classic gay boy syndrome, which I had sort of a critical father, sort of disinterested. He did the best he could. My dad never abused me, but, you know, perhaps he wasn't as, affirmative with me or as compassionate as he could have been. And also I was kind of a sensitive kid and, not sporty, got teased a lot. You know, right away got called things, you know, all the slang words for gay and that plays on a boy's mind. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, without even knowing what gay was, I thought, well, maybe I am gay.
Yes.
And then when you're very separated from other boys, and if you just imagine being on the schoolyard and you're, you know, watching all the other boys play and do the sports things and whatever they do, and you're outside of that, and you think, gee, I wish I could be a part of that. I wish I could belong to that. And you start looking very longingly, and that really sets things up. And this is really way before anything is sexual.
Mm-hmm.
at all. So now, by the time I'm a little older, I start looking at
any
porn.
Advice that you'd have for dads out there? For, I mean, this isn't going to be any fear mongering video or anything of, you know, don't let your kids end up like X, Y, or Z.
Right.
But what kind of advice, just even from the very earliest stages, would you have for fathers out there to really make sure that father-son relationship happens?
It's very important. I would always say that the homosexual inclination really begins within the father-son relationship, right? Usually when it's dysfunctional. And it's not necessarily that the father does this on purpose. He's maybe not there, or again, he's disinterested, too busy with work, or just kind of leaves all the child rearing over to mom.
Right.
And and again, there's no malice there.
Right.
But and it doesn't happen with everyone, because I've had so many guys say to me that, you know, I had a bad relationship with my dad,
yeah,
and I'm not gay.
Right.
So therefore, that really has nothing to do with it.
Right.
But it's, you know, being gay and homosexuality in men is pretty rare. It's only about 2% of the population. So only certain boys will be affected that way and,
sure.
and go in that different that direction. So I tell fathers, be strong with your sons, you know, but be compassionate and be loving, you know, hug them, you know, correct them. It's very difficult. It's kind of like what makes a good priest also makes a good father,
yeah.
and what makes a good father also makes a good priest.
And that,
you know,
that 2%, is there a correlation in that 2% with boys or men who had been, you know, you use the word dysfunction. I think a lot of people think dysfunction means abuse, but as you pointed out, that can just be neglect. Have you seen any statistics that really connect that 2% of the gay boys and men to absentee fathers?
Yeah, well, most, when they've done studies, and they don't do them because now they're very politically charged, but most gay men will admit that they didn't have a good relationship with their father.
Yeah.
So, but then there's other factors. There's molestation, there's abuse, and there's also pornography, early exposure to pornography.
And I want to get to that in a second, but I think one of the things you said that might surprise some of our listeners is dads should hug their sons and be affectionate. There might be some real dads out there who would think, well, no, I don't want my son to become gay. Why would I hug him and become affectionate? Could you speak to why that's actually important to be affectionate in a good, healthy, manly way with your son to develop a normal sexuality?
If you, and I tell this to dads, if you do not hug your son when they are young, they are going to find some other man who will, okay? And a lot of times that man that they find does not have your son's best interest at heart, okay? So you have to... I mean, if men have that problem with showing affection physically, they need to work it out.
Because I like how you said it, that dads don't hug their sons, eventually those sons are going to go find someone else.
Yeah, it's very... Yeah. With my experience with gay men in particular, is they have very good relationships with their mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes too close, too cloying, where they become facilitating very affectionate relationships,
yeah.
very close, almost like you would have between a mother and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's always the opposite mm-hmm. with the dad,
mm-hmm.
where the dad is cold, standoffish. And it goes back to childhood. And sometimes, but it's interesting because sometimes in the same family where you have a gay boy or a pre-homosexual boy, you'll have a brother who is heterosexual.
Yeah.
But sometimes there is with that boy, and I think it was with me, is you have a boy that's sensitive,
mm-hmm.
doesn't want to do like the things with dad, maybe doesn't want to work in the garage on the car, doesn't want to do sports, doesn't want to chop wood, doesn't want to fish, would rather maybe go with mom and do cooking. And that doesn't mean that that's wrong, that those things... that boys can't like other things. They don't have, everything has to be like a typical masculine
sure.
thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be gay, because again, it's rare. But I think if a father that has a boy like that, where they're not connecting, and I've talked about this with fathers, they need to make that special effort to connect with that boy and say, let's do this and let's do that, and be patient with him. If he can't put the worm on the hook or something, you know, be very patient, or he can't work with tools, or it's not coordinated.
Yeah.
You know, you got it. Don't just shluff him off to mom and say, well, she does. He's a mama's boy.
But anyway, let's talk about the pornography. Because you had mentioned in one of your videos, it was straight porn that led to your gay lifestyle. And that's a tough topic, but I'm really interested in you talking about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the 70s, it was so different because, you know, gay pornography was not readily available at all. You had to come here,
mm-hmm.
really, to the Castro to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But straight porn, you know, Playboy, Penthouse, even Hustler, that's, you know... us boys, we had them. We either stole them from our fathers or our older brothers,
right.
or just took them out of the liquor store or whatever. So we had it. And, you know, a lot of that porn, even in the 70s, was crossing the line into, you know, bisexuality or ménage à trois or whatever. And so, I mean, it was intriguing to me because, I mean, all kids are interested in sex.
Yeah.
No matter, you know, what's going on in their mind.
Except for a few of those saints that you read about who were just shielded their whole lives.
Not me, but so, and you know, pornography is, you know, is very intriguing to someone who's like a pre-homosexual because it's a fantasy world,
right.
And because
right.
we're either isolated from boys or we're isolated from our fathers, oftentimes we do get into this fantasy world. That's why we love like The Wizard of Oz and, you know, all the Broadway shows and musicals and things, because yep. it's this very sort of perfect world.
Mm.
And pornography's that way. And so I got into it, magazines, and then I started ordering, because at that time you could order it in the mail and get the video cassettes. So I was ordering, and then I was ordering gay porn.
Okay.
Because I wanted to be with men. I felt so distant from men. And that was kind of a revelation to me, is you see, because I didn't know anything about gay or gay sex, man. So, and then you see two men, and it's kind of like, wow, I'm not the only one. There's other men here that are doing it, and it's...
And you grew up outside of San Francisco. Tell us about what led you finally to San Francisco, specifically this Castro district outside right here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I came out probably at the worst time, which was 1988. It was the height of the AIDS crisis. So, I mean, I sort of knew that there was a gay culture out there, a gay world, from like Three's Company or different, you know, movies or TV shows. And then with just on local TV, just with so much coverage of the AIDS epidemic, I understood that there was a gay male community here. Was scary because, you know, everybody was... It seemed like everybody was dying,
right,
to me. So, you know, I knew that this would be a place of acceptance for me, where men and, you know, no straight men ever reached out to me to be my friend. So I figured I will come here and there are men here. And I knew... I mean, I was scared because I knew that coming here could mean my death, but I would have rather died than be alone anymore. It's just sad.
So, on the way over here, yeah. I had mentioned that a lot of the people who are involved in that lifestyle hate it, but they're too lonely to leave it. And you corrected me and you said that they're unhappy,
yeah.
but that doesn't weigh as much as the loneliness or something like that. Can you speak to that?
Well, you don't feel like you have anywhere else to go. I never thought I had anywhere else to go. I just thought, I mean, I even had a priest tell me that when I sort of confided in him, and he said, well, you know, this is, you were born that way, and this is where you need to be. You need to be with people that are like you.
So, Joseph, could you tell me a little bit about how you came here, and then just how things went from, you know, curiosity to the extreme lifestyle as best as you can describe in a PG-13
yeah.
way?
Yeah. I just drove down here. I knew where the Castro was. I just drove down here, and I had always wanted to get out of the town I was born in and get away from my family. So I went to UC Berkeley, just across the bay, and just took the subway over here into the Castro. And when I first got here and walked into this place, I really did feel like Dorothy. I know this sounds crazy, but there's so much symbolism with The Wizard of Oz and the gay community. They show it every year. Mm-hmm. It's a high holy day when they show it every year at the theater. And there's this scene in The Wizard of Oz where, you know, everything's black and white and it's sepia, and she opens the door and it's Technicolor. And it's like, whoa.
Okay.
And that's kind of what I felt when I got here, because, I mean, besides all the rainbow flags and everything, it was just like, this is where I was meant to be. because I walked down the street and I wasn't worried about the way I sounded or the way I walked. I wasn't worried about the way I moved my hand, you know, that people were going to tease me, because everybody here was kind of the same. So it's like I found a community, I found a home, and I was overjoyed.
One of the things surprising that I found in your videos was that when you first come as a young man to the Castro, there's a relationship, a pseudo-relationship of usually finding an older partner who sort of is a dad figure that takes you under his wing, expects favors, of course, but takes you under his wing. Can you talk a little bit about this kind of pseudo-father role that also becomes almost an abusive role, or maybe I'm putting words
No, you're correct. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens a lot. So when I, you know, walked into a gay bar just around the corner, it's still there, and, you know, sat down at the bar stool, I was scared to death. But, I'm, you know, an older man, you know, twice my age, approached me, and again, a man had never touched me. I haven't been hugged in years. I mean, a man has really never talked to me. I had mainly girl friends,
right.
Friends that were girls in high school, and which is typical. And so when a man approached me and said something nice to me, I couldn't believe it. And if he would have asked, you know, I left with him, so that was it. And again, he was older, and it's sort of like a pseudo father son relationship, like you're talking about. And there I was, and it worked for a while, but then this is getting really complicated. But I was trying to deal with so much in my childhood through sex,
okay.
And sex doesn't heal what's going on with you. You think it does, because you want to be with men and you want to have a relationship with men, and you think, well, the most intimate way to do that is through sex.
Right.
Really, it's not.
And why does that lead to more and more kinky behavior?
Okay, we when we were walking over here, they have different plaques on. It's kind of like the Walk of Fame, like they have in Hollywood. But these are gay, LGBT famous people,
mm-hmm.
Famous people in the LGBT community. And one of them was Randy Schultz, and
I saw that.
Yeah, and I knew him when he was here. I shouldn't say I knew him. I met him, and. He wrote the book And the Band Played On, which was about the early AIDS crisis, and specifically in San Francisco. And he wrote something very profound in that book. And I repeat it all the time because I think people completely missed it. And when I read it, I missed it. He talked about, in an all-male community, you do not have the moderating... And this is a gay man writing it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in an all-male community, like here, you do not have the moderating influence of women.
Okay.
Women to say no, because male sexuality and female sexuality are very different.
Right.
Are complete.
No, right. Fulton Sheen actually said he could always put PG-13 terms in G, and he said, man teaches his wife the pleasures of the flesh, and the wife teaches the man chastity.
He said that?
He said that.
God bless him. And then what I was saying about Randy Schultz and the all-male community... And what you have, you really have nothing to stop sort of the downward spiral of perversity. Because, I mean, for a while I was bisexual. And even in the same time frame, I was sleeping concurrently with women and men. And I saw right away, even among prostitutes who I went to, they were not willing to do what men were willing to do. So, in an all-male community, it can really, really go downhill very fast. And that's what happened to me. And this mirrors with porn. Because if you look at people that start looking at porn, they start looking at things that are pretty tame.
Right.
And then, I mean, certainly, you know, within a few months, maybe within a few weeks, they're looking at, like, really hardcore stuff.
That's right. And I don't know if you've ever seen the science behind it, but there's this upregulation of these neural receptors, norepinephrine, dopamine, that every time one climaxes, it drops the baseline. So to get back up there, it takes more and more. So there's actually a science of this addiction that usually leads to either violence or children or same sex.
Yeah, yeah. And that happened with me because, you know, even when I was here with AIDS and I had to be careful, and I said, you know, there's things I'm not going to do. Mm-hmm. Part of it was because of disease, and part of it is just because I didn't want to do it. And then I was sort of, I had shocked myself by how later I got into things that I had never thought I would do.
Like boundaries that you said you'd never cross, you cross them.
Oh, yeah.
But not that one, and then you cross it, not that one, but you cross it.
All the time. Mm-hmm. And I see it with young people that when I outreach here, is the stuff they're doing now, it's younger. The stuff they're doing in their like early 20s, I did in my late 20s when I was really hardcore. But a lot of this has to do with porn, is because they're seeing like really, really sick stuff young, which I didn't see because it wasn't even produced. You know, you could buy it if you want it. So to them, it's not that difficult to make the leap and do it in your real life. It's a lot of, it's combustible, but a lot of that is focused into, because you have a whole bondage and discipline world that's very accessible here.
You mentioned 50 Shades of Grey. You know, this bondage and 50 Shades of Grey, it seems like there's some self-hatred involved in that.
Oh, yeah.
Is, what, besides Satan, what's the core of this self-hatred?
I think when... Nobody gets into that as a naive person, I would say. They've already, I mean, that's really the, I mean, just like nobody starts shooting up heroin. I mean, you've done other things before that, whether it's, you know, weed or whatever, party drugs or whatever. So when you get into like the bondage and discipline, the BDS thing, you're at a pretty you know, your inner core right here is pretty empty. And I know when I got into it, I just didn't know what to do. And I just figured I'll do this because the other things I was doing, I wasn't feeling that intimate connection with another man. So
did you ever try praying at this point, or is that all later?
Praying? No, I wasn't. I didn't believe. No, I prayed to Satan, but I didn't know to God. No.
So how bad did it get? You mentioned escorts in your videos. You had mentioned doing videos yourself.
I was never really an escort. More the girls are escorts.
Okay.
You know, like a tall girl.
All right.
What I would do is, there's a park not far from here, is I would just go there at night and just get picked up by men. And I didn't particularly need the money. I mean, it was nice. But it was just, it was kind of like a power trip in my head that men were paying me to be with them. That's when things got really dark, because I was kind of hoping that somebody would pick me up and kill me. And I
remember that from one of your videos. You actually said to someone.
He did. Yeah, I wanted out. He picked me up here, took me across town, and slit my throat. And
knife your throat? He slit your throat?
No, he slit it. He cut it.
He actually slit it.
He cut it. I mean, not. It's kind of complicated, but just kind of went across here, where, you know, where the blood was coming down. I didn't care. I didn't get sick. I was like, fine. I'm ready. I was done.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. It is. I mean, some people get into that, because I know guys that kind of, where they get to a point where it's like, I don't care if I'm HIV positive. I just, you know, I'm kind of done. I just. That's a different kind of... There's all different ways to kill yourself.
I remember listening to one of your talks. When I first found out, is this an exaggeration? Because you said you had to get dragged out of San Francisco. Things were so bad. And I thought, well, that means he had AIDS. But you didn't. You never caught AIDS.
No.
When you said you got so sick, you had to be dragged out of San Francisco, what did that mean?
Well, the Lord had to drag me out. Because...
Was this after the near-death experience?
That's part of it. Because,
okay, go ahead and include all that.
Okay, because even when, you know, things got so dark with me, even when I was ready to just give it up, I didn't care. You know, I didn't care. I kind of had a very weird sense of the afterlife. I had so many friends that had died of AIDS and suicide and drug overdoses. And I just kind of figured that, but I had no concept of like heaven and hell. I kind of believed in an afterlife, but I was kind of like, well, they're just gone and they are finally at peace and at rest. And I was kind of like, you know, this sounds good to me at this point. So I'm ready to die. And when push came to shove and I was going to get hurled into, you know, the abyss, I was like, this isn't the death. This isn't the death that I thought it was going to be. And then I genuinely got scared. I never got scared. And I just said, no. And you know, the Lord, you know,
tell us what happened in that hospital room.
Yeah. I'd been busy that night. And I got very ill. And I went to the emergency room. And my mother showed up. My mother showed up. And she was praying for me. And because my parents had really come, they never really left the faith, but they weren't fervent. They were very lukewarm. So now they were fervent in the faith. And she was praying for me. I got very angry with her about praying. And I was blaspheming. And I was, you know, cursing. And I kind of knew at that point that I was probably dying. Now, when I started doing that, I just saw all of this just very shadowy, nebulous, you know, movement around the emergency room, and they all zeroed in on me because I was blaspheming. And I think they were looking at everybody else before, and they all just zeroed in on me and congregated around me, and then I knew that this wasn't good. And I just got scared, and I called out to God. And
I said at lunch that was Satan, and you knew very specifically it wasn't Satan, but the other demons.
Yeah, I didn't think it was him.
But you knew they were demons, it sounds like.
I knew that, I kind of knew that they weren't good. Mm-hmm. I knew that they didn't want anything good for me.
Oh, and that's right, you probably weren't catechized well enough to say things as demons, but you knew something bad was happening.
Yeah, I didn't know a demon.
Right.
And, I just called out, and our Lord just with his hand, like that, and that was it. And
well, what's that? Was it just immediate peace in the emergency room? What does that mean?
It was kind of peace, but it was also kind of weird because I didn't know what was going on. I was kind of like, whoa, okay. I think that was Jesus. And, you know, I hadn't thought of him in many, many years. Not that I was just lapsed or, you know, a Catholic that didn't believe in him. I didn't consider him anything. He was like Buddha or Confucius or, you know, whoever. He was just some guy. And I was just like, whoa. I said, I don't know what to do. But I said, I'm alive. And I was thankful. And I just said, my parents took me home. And I was really like the prodigal son. Because I had really been a pain, not nice, obnoxious, just awful, and they were not supportive of what I was doing or facilitating. But they never. This, well, it's complicated.
Go ahead.
They always welcomed me home with limits. You know, when I started bringing people home and, you know, have a lot of craziness, my dad said, no, enough, 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 enough. And I was kind of like offended.
Do you think that was important for your reversion to the Catholic faith that your dad wouldn't let your boyfriends around?
Yeah.
Would you suggest that?
He didn't know that they were my boyfriend. I don't think he even knew I was gay. I'm sure he didn't. He thought I was kind of nuts. But he knew that these people and what I was doing and all of us, this was not a good mix. And yeah, when my dad, I point to that day when my father said, you can't bring these people home anymore. And he was very cool about it. He wasn't screaming or yelling or condescending or mean or anything. Mm-hmm. But he was just very, you know, firm and just said, no. And that was so important to me, and now I'm getting into that, another thing, but because so many gay people don't know anybody like that, because everybody's so affirming and believing, and you're born gay and I love you and everything you do is fine, and they don't have a person like that that'll say no. And
don't you think a lot of people out there believe if they say no, they're going to push them farther? And if they push them farther, they push them farther from God, if they're their only connection. Yeah. How would you answer that?
I answer them this way. In order, it sounds like a cliche, in order for the prodigal son to come home, the father had to say goodbye.
Right.
Okay. Because the prodigal son could have done all that stuff at home, you know, with his dad's money, but the father said, no, here is your inheritance.
Yeah. He knew he had to sleep with the pigs elsewhere.
And I did too. It's just because you don't know what to do. And I didn't. Yeah. I honestly didn't. If I wouldn't have had that experience, I never would have known. Because
so here you are laid up at your parents' place, and I think I remember from one of your videos, bed, numerous surgeries. Was this like St. Ignatius of Loyola, who just started picking up some random books of saints, or what brought you deeper into a relationship with Christ? Besides that initial emergency prayer, what deepened that relationship in your recovery time? And how long were you laid up at your parents'?
I was laid up at least a few months, and then I did start going to church, which is a long, complicated story. But my parents had the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you know, and they had the Bible, and they had like Butler's Lives of the Saints.
Like
the big four volumes. So, I did sort of just start looking through the Bible, not knowing what I was doing. But I did find like passages I could relate to, like Mary Magdalene, or like St. John the Apostle, who I related to, because he was like the runt of the apostles, and he was the one there at the crucifixion, the only one there. And you know, just Mary Magdalene, the way she was kind of a harlot, and forgiven by Christ. And I'd read the Catechism, and I just flipped to the part about homosexuality. That's it.
Oh, you flipped through it then?
Oh yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
What? You still weren't ready to?
I wanted to know.
Oh, you did. You did read it.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to know. So I read it, and I just tried to figure it out. I didn't get much help from the church, unfortunately, till later. It was very difficult to find a good priest. There was a lot of trial and error. And again, my heart goes out to people that are gay and want to get out, because I tell them it's kind of like a minefield when you get out of the church, because you kind of think, I don't know what I thought when I got out, because I'd had some bad experiences with priests, but I didn't think it would be as difficult as it was to find a good priest. I ended up...
And I'm certainly not turning this podcast into an apologetic for the Latin Mass, but I do remember it was a Latin Mass priest who did take you under his wing, admit that what you were doing was sinful. I remember you saying deliverance prayer. Can you tell us about that? He didn't let you get off the hook.
No, I met a good priest that said the Latin Mass. I met a good priest who said the Novus Ordo in Latin. And then he was very good. And then I started going to a fraternity, St. Peter Parish. They were very good because, you had the good liturgy, and you had priests who were, I know now it's like toxic to say the word, but who were like, masculine, but very compassionate and caring. And that's what I needed. And, but they were, I don't know, they were just, God sent them to me because I didn't know what to do. Because a lot of gay people, and I say gay, not that they're born gay, that's what they identify.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, that's what they identify as. But a lot of people, the church here, you'll go to the church that's got the rainbow flag flying outside because you figure, oh, they understand me, they're going to help me,
right.
And you're kind of naive, you don't know what to do, and that's what I did.
And then at the end of the day, what's the point of going? Because if they're going to just ratify you in your sin, wouldn't you have more fun things to do than go to Mass? Well, so when in your recovery did you realize you had to repent, make a good confession? When did that actually happen in your recovery?
I had gone to some priests that, like, basically would not, they would not give me absolution because they didn't, I know, I laugh about it now, it's ridiculous. They didn't think I had done anything wrong.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they denied you absolution because there was too many sins, or they thought you were going to go back. These aren't the ones to the right denying absolution. These are the ones to the left denying absolution.
So, I mean, they didn't think I did anything wrong.
You literally got denied absolution?
I don't know what they did, but they just didn't think it was anything wrong because they, they just said, they said, Joe, this is the way you were born, and you are trying to work that out in the only way you can. And they figured that if I could settle down with some, they didn't know that I had, that I tried to, if I could settle down with one person, then it would work out. So, I found it's always the priest you don't want to go to. Okay.
For confession?
It's the one you don't want to go to, period. It's like the one that's rigid. I know that's ever rigid. He doesn't have a particularly, good personality.
Not pastoral.
Yeah, people kind of don't like him. Yeah. He's kind of in an out-of-the-way parish, because TLM Mass is always out-of-the-way. So I remembered a priest when, because my mother and father, this was very early on when I was gay,
yeah,
they would sort of force me to go to Mass when I came home for Christmas and Easter. And I remembered this priest, and I wasn't interested in the church anymore, so I kind of like half heard it. But there was this priest who was just seemed very strict. People didn't like him. And I remembered it. And so, and I had so much trouble finding a confessor. I remembered this priest, so I'm going to look him up. And I remember everything about it so clearly. I got on the phone, he's just like, and I kind of told him very vaguely what had happened. And he's just kind of, so I kind of thought he was going to treat me as like a special case.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to come here. He said, oh, no. This is when I say your confession. Come to the confessional. Like this. Okay. So, he just treated me like a man.
Right.
So, not like a gay person. So I showed up.
Latin Mass. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I showed up.
Yeah.
Went to confession. It didn't take long. I mean, I had 15 years, had done everything from A to Z, but I wasn't going to bore him with everything. I think men don't tend to give a lot of backstory of their sin. I was just like, boom, boom, boom. It took me a minute and a half. He absolved me. The whole confession probably took 5 minutes.
You can say dozens, hundreds, or thousands of times if you have to use those words, right?
Yeah.
Dozens, hundreds, thousands.
So, and he said, okay, you need to go. It was like a Marine. He said, you need to go to the sacraments. You got to do this. Boom, boom, boom. And he's like telling me, okay, and he did the Latin Mass. You got to show up. So I did. And then I said, Father, I'm unhappy. I said, I know you offer the Latin Mass once a month. And he had his own story with the diocese and whatever. And he said, you go to this parish where they offer the traditional Latin Mass. And he said, you just go there and you'll be happy there. And that's what I did.
And Latin Mass aside, because there's good priests in Novus Ordo, there's good priests in the Latin Mass.
And I'm not downing them.
Sure, who would do this, but...
He was a Novus Ordo priest,
right?
Technically.
Okay. But what is it about a man coming out of that lifestyle that needs a priest with real, definitive, doctrinal parameters to actually love their sons without treating you as a little gay case? Why was that what you were longing for in a man and a priest?
I got an answer. What is very attractive about the gay community here, especially with gay men, is it's very structured, and you have a very strict set of, I don't want to be blasphemous, but like dogma or doctrine that you need to follow. And there's just a lot of ritual in terms of how you meet and how you interact, and it's a lot of people think that gay male culture is very effeminate or very wispy or very soft and pink. It isn't. It's a simulacrum of masculinity, but they...
I'll have to look that one up later.
Okay. But it's like a simulation of masculinity, but it's a very hardcore sort to it. So, I mean, that's what's attractive to it, because we want to be with men, you know. So, when we leave, I wanted to be with, I shouldn't say I wanted to be, I wanted to be mentored by a man, and it's sad.
How was this the redemptive side of that, so just playing out the gay world again? Was there, did it feel different?
I mean, it is.
But why?
Yeah, because, see, a lot of people, or I shouldn't say a lot of people, in the church, they feel like, you know, to outreach the gay community, you need to be very soft and very, just very tacitly approving. Yeah.
Right.
But that's not, they're missing it. So when I met priests, and in the but this is important because liturgy has to do with it.
Right.
In the liturgy, you have a very strict set of rubrics that need to be followed. Mm-hmm. And that's what I needed in my life.
Wow.
You know, and in the Novus Ordo, it's just so much is left up to the priests, and, you know, and a lot of times in the outreach, the priest is kind of doing what he wants. But, and in the catechism, it's very specific about homosexuality. And that's what I needed. I needed a rule book, and I needed a way of life to follow.
Okay.
And that's what these priests gave me. And that's what I found in the gay community, kind of.
Right.
And, but it's weird because with my interaction with a priest, it didn't become like a substitute for being gay, where it's like I found like
that's
another,
where I was going, right?
Yeah, I found like a different guy or something. He's just a priest. It's because specifically through the Mass, and, you know, kneeling at the altar rail to receive our Lord, you know, on the tongue, and really truly believing that that was the body and blood of our Lord, because the priest truly believed, is that I could see that transforming me.
Wow.
I could see it changing me, and then my relationship with men was changing. It was just different, and that's because good priests need, in a certain degree, even if they are younger than the person that they're counseling, need to be kind of a father figure. I mean, that's what they're called, father. They need to be kind of a father figure, and with your father, a lot of that stuff is going to be healed.
So it sounds like gay men and straight men both long for this band of brothers, kind of from a different direction. But, you know, I was telling you on the way on the subway ride over here, my two favorite saints, Ignatius and Xavier, who are these bosom buddies of soldiers, essentially, even though one ex-soldier found one guy as a frat boy, there was this friendship that they wanted to fight shoulder to shoulder with each other. And it sounds like in the Castro, that's the same thing, but it's just going awry. It's going the wrong direction in that desire to be shoulder to shoulder. So we'll pick up next week with Joseph Chambre, part two of his escape. We'll talk a lot about families next week, as well as the mercy of God and some more details on that life in San Francisco. You may have noticed that we're going to put this heresy podcast on pause so we can keep talking to Joseph Chambre for these 2 weeks. So God bless. Tune in next week for part two of Joseph Chambre's escape from the gay lifestyle. God bless you.